The Apostle Paul encouraged the churches of Achaia and surrounding communities to participate in a collection for the poor in Jerusalem. You know that in Jerusalem, that place where the church was headquartered first, it was filled with the likes of Peter and James and John and many others who were absolutely crucial to the ongoing efforts of spreading the news of Jesus Christ. Paul called them pillars, as well they should be called. But these persons that were gathered in Jerusalem were living in very difficult situations of need. Now, if you think about this, there at least were two matters that were daily a struggle for them. You remember the profession that Peter, James, and John were a part of before Jesus called them into the ministry. They were fishermen, weren't they? Which was easy to go back to when they were so uncertain about where Jesus was and what was next for them. And in fact, Jesus found them out fishing on the Sea of Galilee. But when they came to Jerusalem, they knew in that place of waiting and at that time in which the Spirit spilled from heaven into their lives and directed them, there was a complete trust that somehow God would provide what they needed, because these were at a distance from anything professionally that would generate income for the early church. They were most certainly in abject poverty. There is no fishing to be done in Jerusalem. Also, they were dealing with a temple that had ostracized them, that had looked at them with suspicion and certainly had closed many doors that might have proven an assistance to getting things going. And so when in the Jerusalem agreement that Paul made with Peter, do you remember that agreement where Paul and Peter were in dialogue, and finally there was this moment in which Peter, it came to him that yes, those who were Gentiles did not first have to become Jewish before they became Christian. Do you remember that little agreement that they made there? Before Paul left their company, Peter said to him, if you're going to do something for us, make sure that the churches to which you go remember the poor in Jerusalem, speaking of himself and the many others that were gathered there in the early Christian community. It was a difficult task for Paul, because approaching those churches that he had planted and that had begun to plant themselves, he knew that he was going to persons that were already in need. And if they were above poverty, it was only barely that they were functioning in their communities as well. In fact, you may remember the way in which he talked about the churches of Macedonia in the 8th chapter, the chapter before the one from which our reading comes this morning. The Apostle Paul says, we want you to know, brothers and sisters, about the grace of God that has been granted to the churches of Macedonia. For during a severe ordeal of affliction, their abundant joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. So we know that he was speaking and making this request into a place of need. He was asking the poor to help the poor. Remember that, okay? He was asking the poor to help the poor. He was concerned, and I don't know if you can see that concern in this image that is before us, but he was concerned about how this was all going to come down. In fact, as he was sending representatives ahead of him, as the story goes in chapter 9, he said, there may be some Macedonians that are with us when we show up to receive the collection that you've already promised that you were going to give. How humiliating it would be for you not to speak of me if that offering isn't nearly as generous as you have suggested that it might be. Now, that sounds like coercive talk, and it wasn't. It wasn't. He was being honest with them about what they had already promised that they would do. And he was seeking to remind them of that, because Paul had spoken well of them to the Macedonians. Now, not trying to focus too much on the history of this, but I want you to get the feel of where Paul was in the midst of asking for that donation. He was not, I do not believe, so much worried about the amount of the money that was to be given. What he was worried about is that the effect of an offering that was not fully invested, what the effect of that would be on the church as they knew it. Not only would the Macedonians be mystified, Corinth would be embarrassed. And Paul said, I would be embarrassed for you. And there were tensions in Antioch. And when Peter and James came, they began to adjust that Jerusalem agreement, because Peter wouldn't sit down at the table with the Gentiles, these uncircumcised Christians, when before things were in good stead between Peter and them. When that happened, Barnabas, who was with Paul, thought it sounded like Peter knew better than Paul. And so Barnabas went over to the other side. It was almost more surely than Paul could take for Peter to be asking for a donation to the poor in Jerusalem for people that he wouldn't even sit down at the table with. Can you see the struggles of the early church? You think our struggles today are bad? You have no idea. The early church was in search of itself, much like the church today is still in search of itself, wondering, who are we? Who are we called to be for Christ's sake? Paul quotes a proverb, which was in common use certainly in his time. All things being equal, he would have said, the size of the harvest depends on the quantity of the seed that are sown. And you know this is the way it goes. In verse 6 here, he says, the point is this, the one who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And the one who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. It's sort of like that parable of the sower that Jesus uses. You remember that one, don't you? Where this sower has a bag full of seed, and he's going out to do the work of casting the seed. He dips his hand into the bag, and what does he do? Parcel out the seed one by one? No. He casts the seed. He projects the seed as far as he can throw the seed in order that he might do some good in the process of casting the seed. Now, as Jesus tells the story, we realize that some of the seed gets pecked away by birds. Some of it sends down some roots into dry ground and it withers, and that some of the seed is choked out by thorns. But, oh, you tell me what happens. Some of the seed, and you can bet that the sower was intending for all of the seed to fall on good ground. The seed that hits the good ground, it comes back so bountifully that the harvest is 100-fold. Now, if you don't think a harvest can be 100-fold, I ought to introduce you to a peanut farmer or two. This is one of my favorite times of year. You've heard me say this before. When the peanuts are turned in the field, the fragrance begins to come through the community and bless us like perfume. It is a wonderful thing. But if you go to the edge of a field and look, can you fathom the idea that each of those plants grew from a peanut? And all of the bounty of those precious nuts that are turned up to dry in the sun, the 100 peanuts that are there, or something of the Lord's doing. The farmer would tap me on the shoulder and say, well, mine too, a little bit. Come on. But you get it. That living bountifully, that there will be a response. When I think about this time of the year, I always begin to think about apples because the stores are flooded with apples, right? And surely a lot of apple trees have been planted since. But can you remember the story of Johnny Appleseed? Didn't you remember that from elementary school? How this one fellow with a pot as a hat would travel up and down the eastern seaboard, going into communities of pilgrims, but also going into communities of the American Indians and sharing these little apple seedlings with a vision more toward the future than any normal soul. And now there are huge regions of the country that are populated with apple trees that are at least the great-grandchildren of Johnny Appleseed's work, right? What a beautiful thing to think about. Generosity, creative generosity, transformative generosity, heartfelt generosity. Do you remember that story of Zacchaeus? And how when the Lord saw him in the tree and invited him to come down because he was going to his house, how quickly Zacchaeus' heart began to change. This one who had lived out his very existence seeing how much he could get out of other people. This pawn of the Roman government who had taken every advantage that he could. Before Jesus left him that day, he said, "Listen, half of what I have, I split it right down the middle and would give it to the poor. And if I've defrauded anybody of anything, I'll give them four times as much as I took from them." You talk about heartfelt. He understood what generosity was about. In that little oasis of Jericho, it had never seen the light of what Zacchaeus was just letting loose in his soul. Each of you must give as you have made up your mind. That's what it comes down to. There is no one that stands looking over your shoulder to see what you're giving and if it's enough to be given. I have no clue. And I can tell you that even our financial secretary, even though she may know because she has to know some things, she limits herself on any kind of opinion. Each of you must give as you have made up your mind, not reluctantly or under compulsion. Get this, for God loves a cheerful giver. Is that any secret? God loves a cheerful giver. He doesn't want it coerced. I want to believe that Corinth really came through on this thing. We don't know the end of the story. We don't even know exactly how the finances were used in Jerusalem, or if Peter and Paul's relationship was so broken that Peter might have refused to receive them. We don't know the end of the story about the offering. But I want to believe that Corinth came through, inspired by Macedonia, who was inspired by the request from someone who loved them and knew what God could do through willing hearts. The first church that I ever served, shortly after my arriving there, within the first year, my first two funerals were of an elderly couple. His name was Marion and her name was Roussel. Marion and Roussel lived in a little shack of a house down a dirt road, around a little bend, and up underneath some old, old oak trees. They were lost in time. Do you remember the yards when you would pluck the grass out and sweep it in order to keep it clean? That's the kind of yard that they had. Marion and Roussel were precious people. By the time I got to that little country church, they no longer, because of their health and their age, they were no longer able to attend worship of any sort. When I would go by their house for a visit, it was always, though, a very congenial time in which they shared something that was uplifting, and especially their daughter, Evelyn. I think it was on my second visit there when Evelyn, before I left, put some money in my hand. She said, "Would you put that in the offering at church for them?" And I looked at Evelyn and I said, "Evelyn, no, they don't need to do this." I was whispering it, of course, because Marion and Roussel were not too far away. And she looked at me with very stern eyes, Evelyn did. And she said, you do not understand. You must do this. It would make them very sad if you didn't take it. I came to a new realization right at that moment about what it takes to make someone a cheerful giver. You know what it is, don't you? It's just a willingness of heart. It doesn't matter where you are in the strata of society. To become a cheerful giver, it has to do with a willingness of heart to set things right. Paul said in the 8th chapter, I'm not commanding that you do this. In the 9th chapter, he said, this is not a compulsion that I am putting upon you, but it is something that you might want to consider. I like what Tim Keller said when he was reflecting on the tithe. Tim Keller, who is now so associated with the Gospel Coalition Online, and Tim Keller said, he raised the question, what if your salary was suddenly cut by 10%? What would you do? And he answered, just as we would answer, if that were to happen to us, we would make adjustments in what we bought, how we lived. We would make adjustments, and somehow we would make it work. Tim Keller went on to say, go do it. Go do it. And let this show your thanks to God for all He has given and continues to give in Jesus Christ. Does that push you? It's not meant to be coercion. I'll never know how you react to this sermon. But you will know. When does this start? The truth is, whenever you choose for it to start, that's when it will start. I love these words. God is able. Those are big words, aren't they? God is able. What a powerful thought that Paul is sharing. God is able, he says, to provide you with every blessing in abundance. Now, this line is subject to abuse. There are at least a few pastors out there that have used it to justify driving Rolls Royces and flying in private jets. You know that's not what it's about. And God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance. It is not prosperity gospel. It's not about believing that for every dollar you give, you'll never hear me say this, for every dollar you'll give, God will supply two to you. You'll never hear that from this pulpit. But I do want you to believe that God is able to provide enough. Is there anybody here that's evidence for that? That God is able to provide enough. How many times has God helped you get through situations where you could not see because the cloud was so thick? And yet here today, in looking back on those things that brought anxiety and even a sense of distrust at a certain point. Hasn't God been faithful to provide enough? Do you believe that God will take care of you? That's not a rhetorical question either. Okay, come on, somebody speak to me here. Do you believe that God will take care of you? Now say it with conviction, okay? Do you believe that God will take care of you? Yes. I do too. One of our friends in need that this church is so generous to have helped many times in the past, he showed up on his bicycle at the office door just this past week. He wouldn't mind me sharing this, but I was so amused by it that when he walked in the door, my reaction was to say, "What can we help you with?" I was doing the preacher thing, you know. What can we help you with? Which is such, that's just the question itself creates such distance. Such distance. It sounds like kindness, but it creates distance between you and the person that is in need. But he forgave me of that quickly. He didn't say it, but I could see it in his eyes. I said, "What may we help you with?" And he looked at me and he said, "Nothing." He said, "I was just stopping by to tell you where I'd been." He said, "I've been under the weather for the last couple of weeks and I hadn't shown up." And I thought, where is God in this man's life? And I know, for in that moment, with the little that he could call his own, it was enough. It was enough. Do you get this, don't you? Isn't this what Jesus was observing in the temple that day when the many who were rich were putting in their offerings, but the widow came forward and put in a couple of coins? Out of her poverty, Jesus was saying, "Oh, she's given more than anybody." Enough. Verse 11 goes on to say, "You will be enriched in every way for your great generosity, which will produce thanksgiving to God through us." Let me just finish reading that chapter. "For the rendering of this ministry not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also overflows with many thanksgivings to God. Through the testing of this ministry, you glorify God by your obedience to the confession of the gospel of Christ and by the generosity of your sharing with them and with all others while they long for you and pray for you because of the surpassing grace of God that He has given you. Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift." And so my question for you, lest you forget, what is that indescribable gift? And that's not meant to be a rhetorical question either. What is that indescribable gift? Jesus Christ. Lest we forget all that He has done for us. What is that indescribable gift? Jesus, who gave His life. The very essence of all that He had to give for us. The very reason we seek to live bountifully.